Britain announces a permanent deployment of two warships in the East Asian waters amid growing tensions between the West and China. A close ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump's arrested and charged with illegal lobbying on behalf of the United Arab Emirates. And Colombians hold fresh nationwide anti-government protests called by a group representing indigenous people, trade unions, and students. Hello and a very warm welcome. Now the UK says that it will permanently deploy two warships to the disputed waters in the South China Sea amid growing tensions between Beijing and the West. During a joint announcement with its Japanese counterpart, British Defense Minister Ben Wallace said the deployment will take place later this year. He added that Britain will also sail a carrier strike group through the Chinese claimed waters in September. China and a number of other Asian nations, including Vietnam and the Philippines, lay overlapping claims to the strategic waterway. In recent months, tensions have flared between Beijing and the West over the issue. Investigative journalist Tony Gosling joined us earlier. He said he believes the UK is deliberately pursuing a confrontational and provocative policy toward China.
The idea of projecting British power over to the South China Sea is very much like the Chinese sailing battleships, aircraft carriers up and down the River Thames. It's not really, the idea is not to be friendly to your foreign power. It's actually quite a provocative thing to do. The British, I think, are just simply part of the US strategy to have a confrontation with China. If anyone remembers about 3 years ago, John Pilger came out with a brilliant documentary, maybe 4 years ago actually, called The Coming War on China. And his prognosis, I think, was absolutely spot on. Brilliant journalist, hardly ever seen or heard in the Western press at all, even though he's one of the greatest journalists there's ever been. And The Coming War on China explains that the West, it looks like it's losing the economic war, and so it's going to go towards a much more provocative potential shooting war in order to try and intimidate China.
Tensions between the U.S. and China have also escalated in recent weeks. Two top economies remain at odds over a range of issues. Division has grown to a new height amid U.S. allegations the Chinese government is behind a massive cyber attack on key Microsoft servers earlier this year, as well as its global espionage campaign. Here's more.
There seems to be no end in sight to the tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, the US and some of its Western allies, including the UK, have publicly accused actors affiliated with the Chinese government of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email platform used by corporations. That has escalated the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing, with the Chinese foreign ministry slamming it as, quote, fabricated allegation.
The US has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept.
For years, the US and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. Last week, China was infuriated further after the U.S. administration warned American companies and investors about the increasing risk of operating in Hong Kong. Washington claimed that those companies face multiple threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data foreign firms store there. The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The UK, a major US ally, is also not far behind. London has now announced it would permanently deploy two warships to Asian waters. That despite China's constant warning to the US and its allies over their military activities in the region. It seems the US and its allies are concerned about China's growing influence around the globe. That was visible in a recent G7 meeting where the leaders of seven wealthy nations agreed to counter China's economic and security influences. U.S. President Joe Biden even urged European and Japanese leaders to offer hundreds of billions in loans to developing countries in a direct challenge to Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's global infrastructure development strategy. Beijing's relations with Washington reached the lowest ebb during the administration of President Donald Trump, who waged a tariff war on it. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under Trump's successor Joe Biden, but he has shown no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies toward China. That has helped bring the Asian powerhouse closer to Russia, with both forming an invisible alliance. Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington sees as a threat to its global hegemony.
The U.S. says that it's conducted an airstrike on al-Shabaab militants in Somalia. The Pentagon said the U.S. Military Command for Africa carried out the air raid near the central city of Galkayo in coordination with the Somali government. U.S. Department of Defense said its initial assessments showed no civilians were killed or injured in the attack. U.S. conducts such strikes in mostly Muslim-majority nations, claiming it's targeting terrorist elements. However, local sources say that civilians have been the main victims of the attacks. A close ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump has been arrested and charged with illegal lobbying on behalf of the United Arab Emirates. Federal prosecutors said that Thomas Barrick failed to register as lobbyists and used his influence to advance the UAE's foreign policy goals in the U.S. Barrick is also alleged to have repeatedly lied during an FBI interview about his dealings with the UAE. Barrick is a longtime Trump ally, and he was chairman of his 2017 inaugural committee. He's the latest in a long line of Trump associates facing criminal charges, including his former campaign chair, his former chief strategist, and his former personal lawyer. Anti-government protesters hit the streets of the Colombian capital, Bogota, as President Iván Duque offers his renewed tax reforms bill to Congress. Clashes also broke out between protesters and police. Protest was carried out by a group representing indigenous people, trade unions, and students. Similar rallies were held throughout the country. Protesters voiced skepticism about the government's promises to improve working conditions for the young in this new proposal. The bill seeks to boost the government's income by nearly $4 billion annually. Nationwide protests have been held in Colombia since 2019 over the tax reform bill, police brutality, and social injustice. More than 60 people have died throughout the demonstrations. Divisions have deepened within the European Union over claims that several of the bloc's member states continue to flout the rule of law. Poland and Hungary have been singled out for particular criticism in the European Commission's annual rule of law report. Jerome Hughes has more out of Brussels.
Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki and the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, are on a collision course. The Commission is demanding that Warsaw adheres to a recent EU Court of Justice ruling that Poland's disciplinary procedure for judges violates EU law.
We will ask for financial sanctions if Poland does not remedy the situation by the 16th of August. Let me repeat that we have said many times, EU law has primacy over national law.
The Commission has just published its 2021 EU Rule of Law report. It highlights concerns surrounding justice systems and corruption. The Commission says it's examining allegations that EU member Hungary has used spyware to hack into the phones of those criticizing Viktor Orban's government.
We will use all the possible tools to receive more information on this. So, of course, at the internal level with the different services of the Commission, we are starting, you mentioned, investigations. We are starting to collect information.
Other EU countries criticized in the Rule of Law report include Bulgaria, Croatia, and Slovenia. Recently, Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša participated in the annual conference of the MKO terrorist organization, sometimes referred to as the MEK. The terrorist group wants to oust the democratically elected government in Iran. Via Skype, former Portuguese MEP Ana Gomes says that the group is mainly funded by Saudi Arabia and Israel.
MEK pays people to participate in their events. So my question is, how much has Prime Minister Jansen been paid by MEK?
Critics say the EU is quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations over alleged rule of law breaches, but is very slow to take action when some of its own 27 member states flout basic standards. The Commission's annual rule of law report repeatedly highlights the importance of media freedom. It's ironic because the EU's closest ally, the United States, continues to block .com media outlets operated from Iran, including PressTV.com. However, people can still log on using PressTV.ir. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
New reports reveal the names and titles of more than a dozen world leaders whose phones may have been compromised by the Israeli-made Pegasus spyware. French daily Le Monde reported that President Emmanuel Macron and 15 members of his cabinet were targeted for surveillance by Morocco's intelligence service. Now, Morocco has denied any involvement in that. Washington Post reported that the phone of Iraq's President Barham Saleh was also targeted. Kazakhstan's current president and prime minister, a circle of people close to the current president of Mexico, and both the king and prime minister of Morocco have all been on a list of more than 50,000 people targeted by the spyware. Pegasus is also believed to have been used to target journalists and human rights activists. And now the annual Hajj pilgrimage, one of Islam's most special ceremonies, is underway in Saudi Arabia. But the country has limited the attendance of the pilgrims, allowing only Saudi citizens due to COVID concerns. Iran's leader also delivered his message on the occasion of the Hajj pilgrimage.
Every year, millions of Muslim pilgrims descend on Mecca for the Hajj pilgrimage. It's a religious obligation on all Muslims who are healthy, financially able, of sound mind, and of age to perform the pilgrimage at least once in their lifetime. The Muslim pilgrimage traditionally begins in Mecca. The pilgrims start by tawaf, circling the Kaaba counterclockwise 7 times and walking between the hills of Safa and Marwa. Pilgrims then spend a day praying in the valley of Mina before heading to Arafat, some 20 kilometers east of Mecca. They then stone 3 pillars in Mina in a symbolic gesture of stoning the devil the following day. After the stoning, an animal is sacrificed to mark the first day of Eid al-Adha, when Muslims commemorate the willingness of Prophet Abraham to make any sacrifice commanded to him by God. The pilgrims conclude Hajj by returning to Mecca for a final tawaf. Although not part of a Hajj itself, many people round off the pilgrimage with a visit to the holy city of Medina, where the Prophet is buried. However, this year, like the year before, Saudi officials have restricted the number of pilgrims to the holy sites.
So obviously, it's going to be a challenge because COVID is a real virus, and it's really affecting the whole world. People have died from this virus, and we've seen what happened in Iran and different countries as well as in Canada. So, to have social distance is difficult when you're doing the pilgrimage. So that is obviously a problem as well. And it does have, restrictions to how much people can maybe attend a Hajj. But at the same time, the Saudi regime is taking advantage of this, right? And they have, pulled away from letting anybody come from different countries in the world.
This year, only 60,000 vaccinated residents of the kingdom are expected to take part.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in his message, called on Muslims to resist aggression and wickedness of Western powers. Ayatollah Khamenei described resistance as the key for the Islamic world to make up for the past when they were subject to arrogant powers' interference.
In a message issued on the occasion of the Hajj pilgrimage, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said Muslim nations have been mostly subject to the aggressive Western countries' greed and interference over the past 150 years. The leader said Muslims should now make up for the past and stand firm against aggression and wickedness of the Western powers. The leader said resistance against the United States and other transgressing countries will help Muslims take their faith into their own hands. He urged Muslims to rush to the assistance of their fellows in Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other countries where the U.S. and its cohorts have been interfering for years.
The intervention in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Afghanistan, you know, all these countries that are in the Middle East that are Islamic by nature, that the majority of people there are Muslims, the American intervention and their hands are in there, and it caused a lot of sedition, a lot of divisions, a lot of problems, and now a lot of countries are suffering economically because the resources are not being used towards liberating their lands and to be more sovereign. And we have puppets that are working in all different countries, unfortunately serving the great Satan, America.
The leader said resistance fighters are eloquently expressing their firm decision to confront every act of interference and malice on the part of the U.S. and its cohorts. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the U.S. seeks to distort the will, demands, and actions of resistance forces in the region. He stressed that such efforts stem from America's deep ignorance about awake and alert regional nations. Ayatollah Khamenei concluded that the primary result of a struggle in the way of God will be to prevent America and other international aggressors from interfering in the affairs of Islamic countries.
Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The largest wildfire in the United States torched more dry forest landscape in Oregon on Sunday, 18th of July, one of dozens of major blazes burning across western United States as critically dangerous fire weather loomed in the coming days. The destructive bootleg fire just north of the California border grew to more than 476 square miles. That is 1,210 square kilometers, an area about the size of the city of Los Angeles. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Associated Press. The piece is titled Huge Oregon Blaze Grows as Wildfires Burn Across Western United States. Largest wildfire in the United States torched more dry forest landscape in Oregon on Sunday, 18th of July, one of dozens of major blazes burning across western United States as critically dangerous fire weather loomed in the coming days. The destructive bootleg fire just north of the California border in Oregon grew to more than 476 square miles, or 1,210 square kilometers, an area about the size of Los Angeles. It is one of at least 70 large wildfires which are currently burning across the United States, particularly in western United States and nearby states. Erratic winds fed the bootleg fire, creating dangerous conditions for firefighters, said Sarah Gracie, a spokeswoman for the firefighting operation. Sarah Gracie added, "We're still facing a lot of weather issues. The winds have been hampering our efforts most of the time." Authorities expanded evacuations that now affect some 2,000 residents of a largely rural area of lakes and wildfire refuges. The blaze, which is 22% contained, has burnt at least 67 homes and 100 outbuildings whilst threatening thousands more. At the other end of the state, a fire in the mountains of northeast Oregon grew to more than 17 square miles or 44 square kilometers by Saturday night, 17th of July. The Elbow Creek fire that started on Thursday, 15th of July, has prompted evacuations in several small remote communities around the Grand Ronde River, about 30 miles southeast of Walla Walla in Washington State. In California, meanwhile, a growing wildfire south of Lake Tahoe jumped a highway, prompting more evacuation orders and the cancellation of an extreme bike ride through the Sierra Nevada on Saturday. The Tamarack fire, which was sparked by lightning on 4th of July, had charred nearly 29 square miles of dry brush and timber as of Sunday morning, 18th of July. The blaze was threatening Markleyville, a small town close to the California-Nevada state line. It has destroyed at least two structures, according to authorities. A notice posted on the 103-mile Death Rides website said several communities in the area have been evacuated and ordered all riders to clear the area. The fire left thousands of bikers and spectators stranded in the small town and racing to get out. Kelly Pennington and her family were camping near the town on Friday so her husband could participate in his ninth ride when they were told to leave. They had been watching smoke develop over the course of the day, but were caught off guard by the fire's quick spread. "It happened so fast," Kelly Pennington said. "We left our tents, hammock, and some food, but we got most of our things, shoved our two kids in the car, and we left." Meteorologists predicted critically dangerous fire weather with lightning possible through at least Monday in both California and southern Oregon. With the very dry fuels, any thunderstorm has the potential to ignite new fire starts, the National Weather Service in Sacramento, California, said on Twitter. Extremely dry conditions and heat waves tied to climate change have swept the region, making wildfires harder to fight. Climate change has made the western United States much warmer and drier in the past 30 years and will continue to make weather more extreme and wildfires more frequent and more destructive. Firefighters said in July they were facing conditions more typical of late summer or fall. California's Dixie Fire, near the 2018 site of the deadliest U.S. blaze in recent history, was 15% contained and covered 39 square miles on Sunday. The wildfire was in the Feather River Canyon, northeast of the town of Paradise in California, and survivors of that horrific fire that killed 85 people watched warily as the new blaze burned. Meanwhile, officials in Montana identified a firefighter who was seriously burnt when flames overtook a crew fighting a small blaze. Dan Stephenson was flown to Salt Lake City Hospital after the wind shifted suddenly on Friday, engulfing his fire engine near the Wyoming border. A second firefighter escaped without injury and called for help. There were about 70 active large wildfires and complexes of multiple blazes that have burnt nearly 1,659 square miles of land in the United States, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. The U.S. Forest Service said at least 16 major fires were currently burning in the Pacific Northwest alone.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering your doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو ذا الرحمن
Allah
هو ذا المنان
لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, coming to you from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting yet again, as usual, from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio is our dear and esteemed guest, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today after last time's session. It was a little bit hectic, if you ask me.
Exactly.
Our question topic, it was the a woman whose husband has passed away, and she marries another man. In heaven, in the paradise, will she be reunited with her first husband? Will she stay with her second husband, and so on and forth? And we had six different scenarios. And we also touched briefly upon the subject of huris, huri'in for women as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite a hectic discussion last time, and we basically reached the conclusion that we do not know for certain, but we have narrations that indicate that according to the woman's nature, she will be pleased enough with one huri'in.
That's true.
As mentioned before, we had six different scenarios mm-hmm. for our question. Please, let's start off with the first scenario.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So the first scenario is that the wife and husband, they both are in paradise. So in that case, if both of them choose each other, they can be together in heaven. Of course, I'm not giving these six scenarios answering your question. I'm talking about all the scenarios when husband and wife, they pass away, and on the day of judgment, we want to see whether they can be together or not. So if both of them are in paradise, they can choose each other. So it depends on the choice of both of them. Now, one interesting point is that according to some narrations, for example, if them, we know that both heaven and hellfire, they have many levels. Not all the people are in the same level. Now, it is very likely that the man is, like, for example, in level 10, and the woman is in level 5. I mean, and the level 10 being better than level 5. So if the man is higher in rank in paradise, and he chooses to be with his wife, then the wife will be raised in rank as well. So it's a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for both man and woman.
So he does not have to descend in ranks.
No. And vice versa, if the woman is higher in rank and she chooses the man, then again they can be together in that higher rank. So it's a kind of reward for these believing men and women, that if they want to be together in paradise and one of them is higher than the other in rank, they will be together in the higher rank, not in the lower one.
As a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
We have a verse in the Noble Book of Quran that, for family, for parents and children, if all of them, they are in heaven, then أَلْحَقْنَا بَهِمْ بُرِيَّتَهُمْ, I think this is the phrase in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will join them together in that higher level of paradise. We are not talking about the scenario in which, for example, the children are in the hell and the parents,
they're all in heaven, in paradise.
They all are in paradise. They will be joined together. We're talking about family. As for wife and husband, they can be if they choose to be with each other. It's been mentioned in a narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. As I mentioned, for all these details, we need the narrations. Intellect has nothing to say in this regard. And we need to refer to the verses and the narrations. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, in heaven, if man is higher in rank than his wife, and the man chooses his wife as his partner, then she would be with him in the other, in that higher rank. And vice versa, if the wife is in the higher rank and she chooses the man, they will be together in that higher rank. So this is the first scenario. The second one is that the woman is in paradise and the man is in hell. In that case, for sure, they cannot be together. The third?
Not only that, she would not want to be with a disbeliever.
Sure. Naturally. And the third is vice versa. The man is in heaven and the woman is in hellfire. They cannot be together. The fourth scenario is that both man and woman, both wife and husband, they are in hellfire. So both of them, they can be together suffering from those.
Yeah, they can be together, no problem.
Yeah, no problem. So there is no issue of being together at all when you are suffering from all those punishments. So
that's good to know, at least.
Yeah. The fifth one is that the man has more than one wife in this world, and all of them, they are in paradise. So the answer to this scenario is that it is up to the man. He can choose any of the women that he wishes, or he's also able not to choose any of them and to be with Hurul Ain. So it is based on his choice. The main scenario that we are talking about is when a woman has had more than one husband in this world, one of them has passed away or martyred and she remarried, and now all of them are in paradise. And as I mentioned in the previous program, some narrations tell us that in paradise, women will not have a request to be with more than one husband. And or even Hurul Ain.
Yes, we said it was contradictory to their essence, to their nature.
Yeah. And if we have this in mind, now we have this scenario that a man has married more than one husband in this world. Now all of them are in paradise. According to the narration, again, it is left to her to choose. So she can choose one of them or none of them. And to be with, when I say none of them, it means that she prefers to be with Hurul Ain, if we accept the idea that Hurul Ain are for both men and women. Now, interestingly, this has been mentioned, the same question has been asked by Umm Salama, one of the wives of the Prophet. She asks the Holy Prophet about this scenario. She says that A man who in this world, a woman in this world, she has married more than one man, and on the day of judgment, all of them they enter paradise. So what will happen to her? I mean, she would be the wife of which one of the men? And as I mentioned, these narration again tell us that because the Holy Prophet didn't say that she can be with all of them. It can again tell us that on the day of judgment in paradise, women will not have the request to be with more than one husband or partner. And then the Holy Prophet says that, O Umm Salama, the man will that woman in paradise will choose the best in her eyes. So because we know that the ranks, the realities are known to all the people in paradise, the woman will see the ranks and levels of all her husbands. So it is left to her. For example, the Holy Prophet talks about the manners of the man in this world. And anyway, the answer to this scenario is that on the day of judgment, if a man has had more than one husband in this world, it will be, and all of them are in paradise, the option is for her to choose one of them.
Just another question there, Sheikh. What about a single woman who passed away also single? Maybe she was never able to get married. What about her on the day of judgment?
It is like the scenario in which the woman is in paradise and the man is in hellfire. So what
you
mentioned
give her
is like
a
that.
Husband.
Yeah.
Find her husband, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
So for example, we can think of many examples. Maybe one of the best examples is Pharaoh and his great wife, Asiya.
Yes, exactly.
We know that for sure he will be in hellfire and she will be in paradise. So for such cases, for the single righteous woman and for women who are in paradise but their husbands are in the hellfire, the answer is that, again, it is based on their options, their option and choice. They can choose those men who are in paradise as well. They can choose one of the men who are in paradise, and the other choice is that they can be with those Hurul Ain according to the viewpoint that says that Hurul Ain are for both men and women. So the single righteous women who have not married at all, on the day of judgment in paradise, they can choose one of the righteous men in heaven. I mean righteous men in this world, of course. On the day of judgment, all the righteous men
of course,
are in
yes.
paradise, or they can be with Hurul Ain. It is based on their choice and option.
Dear Sheikh, you touched briefly upon a subject about a family who are all righteous living together in heaven. For example, a father and a mother and a son. This son, naturally, he will also get married in heaven, assuming, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he will also have a wife. Will this family, this big family, live together in heaven, or will they just separate? Because we have this maybe misconception among us believers that in heaven, you are maybe alone or you're together with other people. So how exactly does this work for someone who does not know if they're going to be with their big family or they're going to be alone? How exactly does this plan out in heaven?
Regarding this, again, I refer to the first point that I mentioned in the first program, that not all the details of the day of judgment are known to us. Now, what many scholars believe, I mean, whether the life in the paradise is social, so to speak, or individual. I mean, as you mentioned, the big families will be together or they are separate from each other. What we can conclude from some narrations, I mean, this is not 100% sure.
It's not certain.
Yeah, because the point is that we do not know about all the relationships on the Day of Judgment. We think about these worldly relationships and then
exactly.
we ask whether the same is the case on the Day of Judgment or not. But the verses and the narrations tell us that the believers in paradise, there are some periods that they meet each other. For example, the verses talk about the fact that the believers, I mean, come around and they talk to each other.
Each other, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And in some cases they talk about the people of the hellfire and so on and so forth. So these verses tell us that at least there are, I mean, periods, time that they are able to meet. This is one answer to your question, but the other narrations tell us about, and maybe verses, that there are different houses, palaces for the believers. So some scholars believe that they, if you can put, if you can use these worldly terms, they will have both types of life. They will have their own so-called private and individual life in their palace, in their homes, with their, wife, for example. And then they are able to meet each other as well. But, they will meet each other on a daily basis or only on Fridays.
We do not know.
We do not know about all the details. But the point is that, again, I repeat the verse that فِيهَا مَا تَشْتَهِيهِ الْأَنْفُسِ.
Exactly.
Whatever the believers wish for, they will be given in the paradise. So if they wish for meeting their father-in-law, for example, their bridegroom, and so on and so forth, their request will be answered right away. So this is, I think, a general principle mentioned in the Quran, that whatever the believers wish for, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give them in paradise. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless all of us to enjoy all these.
Inshallah. Dear Sheikh, your answer is actually, in reality, an answer to many of these questions regarding paradise and heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Will I see my friends? Will they see me? How much will I see them? This is paradise. Whatever you want, you will find it there.
That's true.
So you can just assume that whatever you want, you're going to find it. Mm-hmm. And that should be enough to satisfy this curiosity.
General principle giving answers to all these questions.
Dear Sheikh, today's topic has been very, very interesting.
Alhamdulillah.
We thank you very much for your time. But unfortunately, our session is up for today. This has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان حب آل البيت فرض عندنا حب آل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
Eid al-Adha, or Feast of the Sacrifice, is a major Islamic holiday celebrating the willingness of Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, to sacrifice his firstborn son Ishmael as an act of obedience to God's command. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, the Feast of Sacrifice. Eid Mubarak.
in the limelight.
Photos and videos from different scenes show Israeli settlers and troops from the IDF aiming their weapons toward the Palestinian villagers, says Yuval Abraham, journalist, in an article titled, "On a single day in May, Israeli settlers and troops cooperated in attacks that left four Palestinians dead." Stay tuned for more. Nidal Safadi was a quiet man, his neighbor said. He lived in Orif, a Palestinian village of several thousand people in the West Bank. Just 25, Safadi had three children with his wife and a fourth girl on the way. Orif is not always quiet. With the Palestinian city of Nablus less than 10 miles away, the occupying Israeli regime military established a base on a nearby hilltop in 1983. A year later, it was turned over to civilian purposes, part of Israeli regime's illegal settlement program in the Palestinian territories. Since 2000, a settlement called Yechar has been home to a yeshiva known for its hard-line Jewish nationalist views. The settlement became known for its extremism. The so-called outpost settlements, it has spared, illegal even by Israeli regime law, but nonetheless defended by the Israeli regime, forces have gradually encroached on villages like Orif. Over the past 10 years, settler aggressions have given rise to violent recriminations between the Israelis and Palestinians living nearby. On May 14th, though, Orif was calm, unlike much of the West Bank. In dozens of places around the territory, Palestinians protested against recent Israeli regime provocations, police storming, Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, and heavy bombardment. Shahada said a group of settlers arrived at about 2 p.m., along with six troops, and began wreaking havoc. The settlers uprooted almost 60 fig and olive trees, he said. Then they attacked the school with the stones and broke its solar panels. The damage was still evident when I visited a month after the attack. While the settlers did all of that, the troops covered for them by gunfire, Shahada continued. The troops led, gave orders, everything looked coordinated. The troops pointed for the settlers, where to go, where to uproot, and then they shot at anybody who tried to get close. After a few minutes, residents came to protect the village. One of the villagers who arrived was Nidal Safadi. Nidal arrived at the school terrified, said his brother, who asked that his name not be used for fear of retribution. We have relatives who live nearby, and the mosque's loudspeaker announced that the settlers were attacking, so he ran. Photos and videos from different scenes show settlers and troops from IDF aiming their weapons toward the Palestinian villagers. One video obtained by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem shows a shirtless settler with a face covering walking around and chatting with nearby troops. At one point, the settler armed with an automatic rifle stands directly in front of a troop, takes aim toward the villagers, and opens fire. Other photos shows settlers and troops alike with weapons raised. Amid the chaos, Safadi struck by four bullets in the chest and abdomen, according to Shahada. He died of his wounds. We do not know whether it was a settler or a troop who shot him, Shahada said. We had many who were wounded by gunfire that day. Nine people were hurt. One in the abdomen, another was shot 3 centimeters from his heart, and there was Nidal, who got killed. Shahada went on, "It was a planned attack, revenge, not a confrontation. We used to have clashes every day, and it never looked like that. They didn't use live ammunition before, only tear gas and rubber bullets. Also, more troops used to be present. Safadi's death was one of 11 violent killings of Palestinians in the West Bank on May 14th, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. While Israeli regime media reported that the killings occurred amid clashes, implying the widespread protest over Al-Aqsa and Gaza bombings, at least 4 of the deaths occurred during deliberate attacks by settlers and troops on Palestinian villages, an investigation by Local Call and The Intercept found. The joint attacks by Israeli settlers and troops were not linked to protests in the targeted villages. No demonstrations preceded the violence in 3 of the 4 locations. The incursions all occurred at almost the same time, around 2 p.m., and all involved the settlers destroying agricultural land, including by setting fires as well as stone throwing and the use of live ammunition. Attacks on Palestinians by stone throwing settlers, as Israeli troops stand idly by, are a common occurrence in the occupied Palestinian territories. But since, like those from May 14th, settlers and troops attacking villages in apparent cooperation with live ammunition are unprecedented. The only way I can describe this by calling it militias, said Bonamer Mershad Assad, an attorney and a partner in Hagel Jews and Arabs in Defense of Human Rights, an organization that works in the court system to represent Palestinians who have faced settler violence. These cases in which troops enter villages together with settlers and in which there is massive gunfire by settlers, this is unprecedented. 5 such attacks on May 14th left 4 Palestinians dead. 1 was killed in the village of Asira al-Qibliya in the Nablus area, another in Iskaka near Israeli settlement Ariel, a 3rd in the village of Al-Rihaya in South Mount Hebron, and Nidal Safadi in Orif. In the 5th village, Burin, which is also near Nablus, a similar attack ended without any deaths. Videos, photographs, and villagers' testimonies of the attacks indicate that, in at least 3 cases, Israeli settlers and troops acted as a combined fighting unit, effectively working as a joint militia attacking civilians and firing interchangeably at Palestinian residents. Coordination between the military and settlers is a burgeoning political issue in the occupied territories. Recently, 100 former combat troops sent a letter to Israeli War Minister Benny Gantz, demanding he take action against settler violence that they themselves had witnessed during their service. In the past year, settler violence has intensified and manifested in, among other things, property destruction, stone throwing, and physical violence against Palestinians, the former troops wrote, adding, "We are the ones who witness how the lords of the land behave unrestricted and what this violence looks like on the ground. We were sent to defend them, but were not given the tools to deal with them." Local Call and Intercept sent a detailed description of the findings to an IDF spokesperson, including photographs and footage. The spokesperson said the cases are under processes of checking and investigating. Though the IDF spokesperson declined to comment on many of the specifics, they acknowledged in response to one of the photographs showing a settler closely interacting with an IDF officer in Orif that the settler was in the area without permission. autopsy was carried out on Safari's body nor on those of the other Palestinians killed that day, so there is no way of determining whether troops or settlers were responsible for the deaths. Israeli regime police have not announced any inquiries into the killings. Despite the common time frame and modus operandi, there is no evidence that the May 14th attacks were coordinated. Some settler ideologues, though, did note that the confluence of events, Zevi Sukkot, a spokesperson of the settlement Yitzhar, and a rising online star of the movement, posted photos from some of the incidents on the Facebook. The photos he shared show, among other things, said that Palestinian with a bullet in his head and another with a bleeding chest, as well as a host of bodies lying prone in various settings. The security situation in Samaria is excellent. No need for protest, Sukkot wrote in his Facebook post, asking his fellow settlers to stay at home. He used the common Israeli term Samaria to describe the northern West Bank. There are casualties, lots of people injured, and serious trauma on the Arab side, he wrote. In all my years in Samaria, I do not remember the army being that determined. Many village residents interviewed by Local Call and The Intercept attributed the attacks to revenge by both troops and settlers, apparently for protest against the Israeli regime assaults on Al-Aqsa and Gaza, as well as unrest in mixed cities inside the occupied territories. The incursions fit into a pattern of so-called price tag attacks, where settlers launch retributive assaults on anyone deemed to be even remotely viewed as an obstacle to their movement. The yeshiva in Yachar near Orif was instrumental in formulating the religious justification for price tag attacks. The concept gained notoriety among some Israeli Jews because it rationalized attacks against the Israeli regime military in rare cases where, for instance, the IDF was used to evacuate settlement outposts. The most common targets of price tag attacks, however, are Palestinian civilians. On May 14th, troops were far from being targets or even ineffectual bystanders. Instead, they were active participants and collaborators in the joint assaults. The army now perceives the settlers as an auxiliary fighting force, said Mishadi Assad, the human rights lawyer, adding, the cooperation is more transparent. No one is ashamed of it. The troops see the settlers as a backing force. It is very noticeable. And the settlers, too, are more fearless. It's clear that things have become more organized over the last year.
Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.